Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Peter Campos has been making his groundbreaking video works for nearly 50 years, and he's widely recognized as a major pioneer in the field of video art. Right now, you can see his work in a number of different venues around the city. There's a retrospective of his work on view at the Bronx Museum of the Arts titled Peter Campos, Video Ergo Sum. There's a show called Peter Campos, Shinnecock Bay at the Kristen Tierney Gallery on the Lower East Side. And every night, just before midnight, one of his videos is being shown on screens in Times Square. On top of that, his work was featured in the recent Armory Show. I'm very pleased to welcome Peter Campos to our show now, along with gallerist Kristen Tierney and Noam Elcott, Associate Professor and Chair of Art Humanities at Columbia University. Welcome to our show.
Hi. How are you?
Peter, wasn't your show at the Bronx Museum of the Arts organized by the Jeux de Paume in the museum in Paris? Was it shown in Paris before it came here?
Yes. February, I think, 2017, Jeux de Paume, Place de la Concorde.
Your work is in the collections of the Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney, the Guggenheim, Tate Modern, the Centre Georges Pompidou, many other leading museums around the world. But is this your first major museum retrospective?
Yes, I think so.
It's you definitely don't know? Your first in New York.
Yes, I'm aging. I don't anything 20 years ago, I can't remember.
Well, you prefer to have your name written in lowercase letters, so I'm assuming that you have a tendency to also want to stay out of the limelight at
times.
Yes,
very much so.
Kristen, as Peter's dealer, how were you involved in planning the retrospective? Were you part of the curatorial process?
Yes, in the sense that we do everything that we can to make it easier for the curatorial team. We help them with any of the logistics. We help them with all of the exhibition and installation issues, any kind of content or information, historical research, things like that. We're there to support it.
Noam,
yes.
Can you give us a bit of an overview of the history of video as an art form? Did it grow out of the art film movement?
It's a great question. Video art came from a number of different sources, people working more in film and comfortable with celluloid and perhaps even coming out of more traditional cinematic means. But it also came out of installation art and sculpture and performance art. Various artists who needed to document their work and eventually incorporated perhaps first film and then video, and then discovered that video, with its real-time feedback opportunities, could become an integral part of the work and eventually could become its own work. So video, by the time it arises, has emerged out of not one, but really several different and sometimes competing strands of modern art.
How has video art changed over the years from being shot on home video cameras to today, when almost any one of us has a video camera on a smartphone?
It's a great question as well. I'll throw in my 2 cents.
I'm trying to ask good questions, Noam.
Yes. I'd also love to hear from Peter his thoughts. In terms of the broader perspective, among the most dramatic changes that happened, of which Peter is a key, perhaps the key figure, is that back in the 70s, most video art was on television monitors. Whether it was real-time or pre-recorded, what you were looking at was a TV. At that point, small, boxy, the last thing you'd expect in an art gallery. And by the 70s and really into the 80s, projectors became much more the norm. Today they're so common we forget that they arrived relatively late in the scene. And so with the arrival of projectors, you had the opportunity of full wall or large-scale video projection, and that gave video a complete new presence. That primarily moved toward something like more traditional cinematic means, more traditional narrative or quasi-narrative film. But other artists, and Peter here again is perhaps the key figure, other artists recognize that there are whole new opportunities for engagement in space, engagement in time, whole new relationships between image and viewer. And these are the projections that he initiated in the 70s, and that a few artists, you know, have followed in his stead. But this, I would say, is among the great divides between a TV box and between a wall projection.
And Peter, following up on that, how important is scale? Because I have seen video art that is pretty much minuscule, and then you have one of your works being projected on a huge screen in Times Square.
I think it's about 30 screens in Times Square.
Okay, well, even more. but would that piece be perceived quite differently if it were in a gallery?
Yes. That piece is owned by, one of them is owned by Reina Sofia in Madrid. And they showed it as part of a show just in normal galleries. And then one night they have a special night and they project it on the side of the Reina Sofia and sent me pictures. So it was amazing looking done that way.
I'm asking about the response of the audience to a piece based on how large it is, because your work has been shown in all sorts of different scales.
Yes, I think scale is the key word, and some pieces are good at some sizes, and some pieces are better at other sizes.
They can have a completely different impact just based on how big, how small, and also context. You know, head of a sad young woman looking down on you on 30-some-odd screens in Times Square, that's an incredibly loaded context. I mean, the history of Times Square, its relationship to women in particular in this city, it's all very important. It has a very different impact than if you were to see it, if you were to chance upon it at the Reina Sofia in an exhibition.
And it's a part of the Times Square Arts Midnight Moment program, shown at 11:57 p.m. every night. Have you gone, Peter?
Yes, we went.
What happens when passersby, because, you know, most of the people there at that time are either coming home from work or tourists, do they say things?
I don't know about them. I just know about me. And when the Bronx Museum first proposed this, I said to Kristen, "Oh my God, we can't do this." And then they persisted. Kristen persisted. So I said, "Okay, you can do it, but leave me out of it." So Kristen picked the piece, So I was there as a visitor, as a viewer, in my opinion, and it was spectacular.
I just wonder whether people think that it might be an ad for something, because
no,
they do not.
They definitely do not. What's so incredible about that experience is the way that everyone looks up and starts talking to one another. And I was really surprised at how many people show up in Times Square to actually see the Midnight Moment. Wow. I expected the tourists, I expected the crazy people, I expected everybody in between, but the number of people who are New Yorkers, who are artists, who are art aficionados, who were there to experience it was what surprised me the most. And it really made me feel like my people were there. My community was there.
Now, where do you see Peter's work in the history of the medium? Do you see him as a major pioneer along with Nam June Paik and Bill Viola?
Can I? Yeah. There was a point I want to make, and I think it goes to what your question you're asking. For me, in the late 60s, what brought me to video was Bruce Nauman. He and Pike, I knew Ira Schneider, Frank Gillette, Beryl Caro. I knew people working in video, but it was Bruce Nauman who created art, I felt, with the equipment. He saw what there was about it, and that's what dragged me in. And he used it as sculptural space. I mean, it was, and he created the negative space that's so important in my work.
I always think of him in terms of Los Angeles, and you're very much an East Coast artist in my mind. But
yeah, I don't wear a cowboy hat very often, and I certainly don't keep horses. But no, I've met him once, actually. But his work was just right. And he went on to other things, too, but it showed me what video was.
Getting back to my question now, when did video art actually start popping up? And I've had the great pleasure of interviewing the late Nam June Paik, also Bill Viola. They're the ones that I always associated with Peter, and I guess Bruce Nauman, with the start of this what turned out to be a whole new approach to making art, at least in terms of galleries and museums.
Today, and first of all, to answer your initial question, there's no question in my mind that Peter belongs to the founding father, so to speak, of video art. And it's hard to imagine video art as we know it today without Peter's work and without Peter's influence. Bill Viola, for example, apprenticed with Peter, if I remember correctly, early in his career. So in that case, you have literally direct lineage. For the broader question, video meant something very particular and somewhat narrow in the 1970s, and today it is much, much broader. So video art, to speak of video art today, is almost a misnomer. I would say that video art has been so successful that it no longer can be siloed into one particular area. If you go to the galleries, they're still dominated by painting and sculpture. But if you go to biennials, really the default format are video projection and photography, large-scale photography, as well as installations of various kind. So I think from the 70s to the present, we've seen video move from the margins, and sometimes really the degraded margins of art, to its absolute center.
Because museums tend to be slow to accept any new approach to work, but now they all, as you point out, they show video art as a major part of any biennial or any show that's kind of talking about what's going on right now.
Yeah, in this case, I think the real laggards aren't the museums. The real laggards are the art market. Video is harder to sell. It doesn't exist the same way as a unique original, the way a painting obviously does. It doesn't build on hundreds or thousands of years, ostensibly, of erratic value that have accumulated. And I think that it's actually the buyers who've been extremely slow and the market that's been extremely slow. And given their prominence within the museum gallery network, I think that largely has hindered its centrality. But museums, biennials, those institutions that are less beholden to the market have recognized, I think, the deep and lasting significance of video art generally and Peter's work in particular.
Kristen, as an art dealer, also somebody who was an art educator when you were at Christie's, is part of your mission to educate collectors and museums on the history and importance of video art?
Yes, definitely. I mean, honestly, showing the number of artists we do who either are primarily video artists or who have video as part of their practice, it's a little bit like, you know, being a preacher or proselytizing. You know, you're constantly on a mission to convert. I mean, I agree with Noam in the sense that when you go to biennials, when you go to these international sort of global expositions, you do see video, projected image, new media absolutely everywhere. And I truly believe that that moving image is the medium of the 21st century in the same way that photography was in the 20th century. But people are, you know what? People lack imagination. They're short-sighted in terms of how they think about collecting art, and they get nervous about the idea that they're buying technology and that it might be outmoded. And I think oftentimes people forget that they're walking around with technology, you know, their phones, their flat screens, their smart TVs, all of these things they're completely comfortable with.
What are the technical requirements for showing this kind of art?
It depends on the artwork, actually, and on the space itself. I mean, Peter and I usually have a series of discussions. Do we want this to be projected? Is this going to be flat screen? How many works? How do we want it? You know, what's the relationship? But ultimately, the artwork exists on a small chip that then...
It's as big as my pinky nail.
Yeah.
Really? So then you just have to decide how you want to present it?
Well, there's always that issue. It depends on where, and it depends on the space. I mean, I always want to get a good look at the space before I even think about what's going to go in there. And then I think there are two very different aspects to video. One is making something for public situations, like the Judapum. They commissioned me to make a work, and it was clearly going to be in a large exhibition space. So I made a four projected screen work called Convergences.
And is that also at the Bronx Museum?
No, There was no space for it. Mm-hmm.
But it will be at the final stop in North Carolina. It'll be at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art and Haynes Gallery.
So this show is traveling?
Yep.
Yes.
But just keeps going and going and going.
No, stop. But also there's screens. Doing works for screens. And I grew up with art in my home. Obviously not video, but, you know, paintings and woodcuts and drawings that my mother collected. And I like the idea of showing my work in homes. And that obviously does not mean projection. That means having the work on a screen.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. My guests are Peter Campos, who has a number of shows around town right now. His gallerist, Kristen Tierney, who has a gallery. This is the inaugural show. She's just moved from Chelsea to the Lower East Side, and Peter Campos is her first show. And we're speaking with Noam Elkott, who's associate professor and chair of art humanities at Columbia University. Peter, in preparing for the retrospective, did you go through all of your early work to choose what you included?
I worked with the curator in French's Commissar, which I think is bizarre.
The reason I ask is years ago, in speaking with a great photographer who was putting together a collection, a book, and he looked at the old pictures, and he discovered that many of the negatives that he did not think were all that interesting when he took the pictures were the more interesting pictures, and the ones that he had exhibited at the time, some of which became famous, now looked kind of obvious to him. Do you, when you looked at the older work, did you have a different perception of some of them?
Well, first of all, I was working with Anne-Marie Duguay, who I had known for 45 years, and it was a big wrestling match trying to pick works for the show, and it took us probably about a year to pick the works. But to answer your question, I'm not like that at all. I'm kind of blind to anything that's more than a year or two old.
Well, you have said that one of your most famous works is something you've come to hate. We'll get to that later.
Yes. So for me, it's difficult to choose. But I thought we did a good job for Jeu de Paume.
Was it difficult to find replacement hardware for works that were made 40 or 50 years ago?
So that's... I have philosophical differences from other people, and that's touching on one of them. I think of my work as philosophical, basically, so I try to keep them as current as possible in the technology. And the technology keeps getting better. So works before, for someone's home, that we'd have to have a big player, a Blu-ray DVD or something on the floor, and all kinds of wires. Now everything fits within the TV set.
So you just transfer everything into digital?
Everything has been digital since 1995.
You began working with video in the early 70s, or even earlier, right?
69.
How did you get into it? Did you, because your degree was in experimental psychology, and your father was a doctor, wasn't he? Did he want you to become a doctor?
He sure did. The last thing he wanted me to become was an artist. I mean, he couldn't bear the idea that I was doing that.
So, but you fooled him, and you wound up not only making art, but also making a success of it?
I think that fooled him. I'm not sure he never would discuss it with me. I mean, he never really came around. He resisted it. And when I went to him and said, you know, will you help support me? I want to be an artist. He said, no, I won't do that because I don't want you to become an artist. Why don't you go into your brother's business? And my brother was working in the film business. So I went to film school, and my brother got me a job in the film business. And it was a meaningful part of me becoming an artist was my 10 years of work in the film business.
And you've cited one of my favorite filmmakers, Michael Powell, as a major influence. How come you didn't wind up making movies?
Yeah, because I didn't want to work with a crew. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was that simple. I just couldn't see myself. My brother was the one who did that. He liked bossing people around. And so he liked being surrounded by a crew. I had no interest. I did 2 or 3 years working with a 70-person crew. And it's, you know, I don't know how much you time you have. We hear about Antonioni going off in the morning and sitting in a chair and thinking for 2 hours while the producer's saying, oh, my God, this is costing me thousands of dollars. But I couldn't see myself doing that. If I had 70 people looking at me, I'd want to do something. So I liked working on my own, and that seemed to be a major part of it.
And initially was part of the appeal of video that it seemed like a bridge between documentary films and painting?
You know, the scientist in me was the part of me that was interested in video. It was it looked, sounded, acted different than film.
But video was very different than filmmaking at the time.
Well, I mean, the video camera seemed very different. And as things have come around, like digital work and now 4K, that everything I'm using is what I learned in the film business.
Well, those old video cameras didn't come up with the clearest images.
No, so but that was interesting about it.
Were you able to manipulate video images on a computer back in the 70s?
No. I don't even know what a computer was in the 70s. It was something that battleships used to get their shells in the right place or something.
So how did you pull some of these things off?
Well, I was interested in the technology, I guess. I like to take the video cameras apart. So in the piece that's showing in Times Square, the effects that I got was by taking the camera apart and just taking my little screwdriver and turning it this way and that way until the image looked like I wanted it to look. Mm. And it's totally taking it out of spec. If you went into a video control room at a TV station, they'd kick you out if you tried to do something like that. So there was no possibility of working that way. I mean, in a commercial place.
Well, you have worked in commercial situations, but go ahead, Kristen. Yes.
I was just going to say that I think one of the things that makes Peter as important as he is the fact that they're not just videos and video recordings, but they are video that's a kind of continuous live feedback and video installation. And so in order for the artwork to actually be an artwork, you need the presence of a spectator, you need audience or a viewer to walk into the space and then actually activate the camera, thereby creating a presence on those screens. And as soon as they step away, it stops. And so there is a sort of you know, this idea of the performative being an essential element of these pieces, and also the way that they functioned as a mirror very often for the spectator. You know, the camera is turned on them in a literal and figurative way. I think
because
that's
some of
critical.
These are surveillance cameras being used. And Peter has said that we perceive ourselves differently through electronics than we do if we're looking in a mirror or just thinking about ourselves. So that's part of it, the taking something that we think we know and showing us that we don't always know it the way we think we know it.
Yeah, that's my psychology training, I guess. But it's always trying to look deeper into things and see what's really behind them.
And you've called the Bronx show, or the Jeu de Paume show, video ergo sum, video therefore I am.
Yes, thank you. It's a joke, and you're the only person who seems to have gotten it. I thought in France they'd all get it because they all studied Latin, but they didn't. They stopped studying Latin decades ago, so no one seemed to know what that meant.
That's because they put Descartes before the horse there.
Oh, God, yes. So to the point.
Your earliest works are in black and white. Was that an aesthetic choice, or was that simply because that's what was available to
that's
you?
That's all there was. But then it became deeper for me. Then the video that I was presenting was really talking about some other dimension and to make those two dimensions work. I mean, for example, I'd never make interface, which is video sort of merging with a mirror image. I'd never make the video image in color. I just couldn't imagine it. The fact that it's in black and white is very important. And now black and white has a very different meaning, doesn't it? I mean, it's you see it used in advertising in a very particular way. And I think it's representing some other kind of dimension.
Many of the works in the show haven't been seen for years. Where have they been?
I don't know. Hiding.
Two of the early works in the Bronx Museum, Kiva and Optical Sockets, used closed-circuit surveillance video cameras and monitors.
All the work actually does. All the work from the 70s uses surveillance cameras. But a point I was trying to make before was that I really want them to be up-to-date, so we try to use the most up-to-date equipment. The projectors that I used in the 70s weighed 180 pounds, and they were in two parts, and I lived on the third floor, and often I was fit. I was carrying up these damn projectors up and down from the third floor. It's like, pay a lot of money to do that now.
Were those early works partly a way to investigate the psychological effects of surveillance?
I wasn't thinking of surveillance at the time. I was thinking of a closed situation, a closed circuit situation, where to complete the circuit, someone had to step in and be part of the image. I wasn't thinking of surveillance that people didn't know about. I was thinking about surveillance that people did very actively know about.
And in this case, when they walked into, when there were surveillance cameras on different parts of a room and people walked into the middle of the room, they saw themselves from different angles.
The camera's very present, and they can see them and sometimes kick them.
The crazy thing is that these works that were created in the early 70s resonate so powerfully with the millennials and a younger generation of people who've grown up with things like reality television and have embraced the idea of surveillance in ways we could never have anticipated.
Right now, when you just watch any news show, if somebody's mugged on the street, if we have any video of it, it's usually because there was a surveillance camera nearby.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
I think it's worth noting that already in 1976, in one of the most famous essays on video ever by Rosalind Krauss, Video, the Aesthetics of Narcissism, Peter's work plays a central role, and the idea of some type of narcissistic relationship to the image, which may or may not be what's going on in Peter's work, But that type of narcissistic relationship, which we, I think, too quickly ascribe to millennials as being, you know, pure narcissists or what have you. But
what's your precedence?
Clearly, what's that?
Well, right now there's a lot of talk about narcissism in politics.
Oh, yes, yes, that narcissism as well. So let's say the general narcissism of social media, that was already recognized in 1976, so early in Peter's career. And I think that more than this question of surveillance and state surveillance and those also very important questions, there's a more intimate, psychologically fraught, and today no less relevant component of narcissism, of self-gazing, of questioning, of a divided self, of a self created by media that is the same or different than the self that one recognizes in a more traditional mirror. And these are questions that I think are challenging, especially for the millennial generation, but we see them already playing out in Peter's work in the 1970s.
For me, narcissism is a kind of loneliness. And I'm wondering what part of that is going on now, that kind of isolation that produces loneliness, and what is the remedy for that?
I'm speaking with Peter Campus, who is the subject of three different kinds of exhibits right now in New York, and with Kristen Tierney, who's opened a new gallery on the Lower East Side featuring Peter Campus's work, and Noam Elcott, associate professor and chair of art humanities at Columbia University. We're talking about video art and the work of one of the fathers of video art, Peter Campus, who is subject to a number of different shows in New York, and we'll go over those again. We're speaking with his gallerist, Kristen Tierney, and with Noam Elcott, associate professor and chair of art humanities at Columbia University. Noam, what happened when video art suddenly popped up? It was it didn't exist, and then suddenly people started making it. What do you think that was all about in the late 60s, early 70s?
That's a complex question for which I don't think I can provide any type of definitive answer.
I guess I'm going to have to ask Peter for that. But go ahead.
Yeah. I would say that film had already emerged as an important art form, and obviously film, going back to the end of the 19th century, is something that artists were contending with in various forms, and certainly by the 1960s, something that traditional artists, you know, traditional visual artists, were also engaging. That existed for some time, so that when video as a technology comes around, there's already interest in its possibilities, and as we mentioned earlier in the conversation, artists trained in film, artists working in performance, artists working in sculpture, artists even working in painting, all recognize in video some new possibilities and gravitated toward it.
And I think we are more a group than I've seen since 1970. I mean, artists were working. We went to the same things. If there was a Steve Reich concert, we went to that. If there was something that Yvonne Rainer was doing, we went to that. So all these things were working together. But it was also a moment where the art world, the commercial art world, had a moment of breaking down. And artists and galleries were really criticizing the galleries for their commercialism, which was, I think, rather funny in retrospect. But and so it was a moment where
That was the Soho moment, wasn't it?
It was the Soho moment, and
where suddenly we had gone from a time when the galleries were on Madison Avenue and 57th Street, and maybe one or two people might be in a gallery when you entered it, to the Soho situation where the galleries are often so crowded it was hard to get to see the work.
And it was 420 West Broadway. At one point it was just 420 West Broadway, and there was Castelli, Sonnabend, and Weber, you know, and it was quite an edifice at the time. But so it was the great moment for video to come in. Prior to that, it was Super 8 films, and
which you edited very differently.
I mean,
did you use Super 8?
No, never.
But video editing was quite different.
It was bizarre. I mean, it was hard work because if you had shot 1, 2, 3, 4, and you said, okay, I want to change shot 2, you had to take everything apart and go back to shot 2
Is this why, for a while, you worked at WGBH in Boston, because they had the equipment?
Well, that was slightly different. But editing was, I decided not to edit in my video because I was a good film editor. I knew I was really good at film editing. So I couldn't do that in video, not till 1995. So I just didn't want any part of it. I did everything in one take, one shot.
Well, how could you have pulled some of these things off? For example, I mentioned that you said that you hate your most famous earlier video, Three Transitions, a video that has some wonderful surreal elements to it. You made it as a transitions for on a TV station?
Yes, was what I thought we were doing, but they told me no, GBH didn't want to do that, but that I made them to go in between, you know, like show breaks, like at the end of whatever show on PBS, they'd have a break, and I wanted my work to be in there. But GBH didn't want to do that.
But you pulled off some incredible things. A man walking through, his clothing, a piece of paper, and then we see someone putting on his face, which renders those areas transparent. I can't imagine GBH turning that down. but it looks like that was complicated to pull off.
Yeah. I think, yes, I mean, I knew television very well. I'd worked in it as a business, so I don't know where these thoughts came from. I don't know where half the thoughts I have come from, but, you know, it seemed logical to me and easy to explain. I mean, for the one going through paper, I just set two cameras pointing at a piece of paper in between. So one camera is there, one camera is there. Here's a piece of paper in between. I mean, it seems simple. The same thing, I'm using basic chroma key. I just decided to do it to my face, so I applied blue paint to my face. So
they still use blue as the thing to project other images onto.
Right.
Today it's mostly green, actually.
Is it?
It's green screen now, yeah. But I'm glad, because I didn't want any green on my face.
What was your response, Noam, when you saw those pieces? Did you think that they were a wonderful breakthrough, or can you understand why Peter has come to hate them?
I can't explain why he hates them. I love these pieces. My first book was called Artificial Darkness, An Obscure History of Modern Art and Media. And one of the things I studied were the forerunners to the contemporary green screen, previously the blue screen. It was actually a 19th century invention called the black screen, which was a velvet light trap that allowed for multiple film exposures. And that eventually became the blue and green screens we know today.
So that was optical, what we called in the business optical, making opticals?
Making opticals, yeah. And that has a long history that goes back to 19th century science and perhaps is most famous in early film in the figure of Georges Méliès, the great magician of cinema. But it survives in Invisible Man and numerous other films in the intervening century. Interesting to me, I discovered at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century a motif of men doing horrible violence to themselves using this black screen technology. And this was not common. When you think of like beheadings and what have you, you're usually envisioning male magicians doing horrible things to female assistants, but in this motif, for reasons I couldn't initially explain, it was men performing horrible violence to themselves, like Méliès decapitating himself.
Would he have been a pioneer of video art, in a way?
Yes.
Méliès was certainly a pioneer of film, and what's interesting is he was a pioneer of these screen techniques that seemed to not differentiate so dramatically between black screens, blue screens, green screens, what have you. And so this, when I saw Peter's work, where he's defacing himself using this video technology, I said, I know this. This is a powerful man inflicting violence on himself using this screen technology. I've seen this before. I've seen this in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
But then, Peter, you stopped making videos.
Can I say that I was ironic in that?
Well, of course.
I mean, I'm replacing my screen, I mean, my face with the exact same face.
With your face.
Yeah. So this is humor, I think.
Yeah, I think and Milius, Milius, to be clear,
Milius is doing
it humorously as well.
Oh,
so
good.
In many of these instances, this is tongue-in-cheek or humorous or entertaining. What have you. It oftentimes actually involves not only bodily violence, but also bodily duplication. So Méliès is the one-man band. He's playing all six instruments in a small orchestra. And that motif, that violence and bodily repetition, is a motif I located in the 19th century and rediscovered gloriously in Peter's work.
And didn't he also make a film about going to the moon?
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's the most famous Méliès film. Not equally relevant in this context, but yes.
Just indeed. So that listeners who would may be aware of that film. Anyway, you stopped making videos. You turned to photography in 1978 and stopped shooting humans because that was pretty much what you were doing with your film or your videos, and turned to nature. What happened?
Well, I don't know exactly what led up to it, but I had a Deutsche Akademische Austauschdienst, which is a grant to live in Berlin. And I was living in Berlin, and as a good Jewish boy from New York, I was living in a Nazi sculptor's studio, which is where they put me, and in Dahlemdorf. And I was extremely unhappy, but I also was looking, I had a show at the Neue Berliner Kunstverein, and I was looking at, in the newspaper, what I looked like posing in front of my work, and I looked incredibly disturbed to myself. And I looked at that work, and it seemed disturbed to me, and I seemed to be exploring all these aspects of psychology that were kind of, I decided it was like a trap. So I wanted freedom from that trap, and I just walked out of my studio. I had to sleep there, but I walked out every day and roamed the streets of Berlin.
With a Polaroid camera.
With a Polaroid camera.
And you spent 18 years making photographs, but at the same time, weren't you also making computer drawings and digital collages?
Yeah. I was interested in a lot of things, and that's always been interesting to me as an artist, is to just go wherever I want to go.
And then you returned to working in video in 1996, attracted because the technology had changed and allowed you to do things that you might have wanted to have done in the past?
I had a student who was rich enough to buy a video editing system that was costing about $30,000 at the time, and his videos really improved. dramatically. All of a sudden he was doing something interesting, and he had a great interest in music and aspects of editing that I knew from film editing all of a sudden were possible in video. So it interested me. And also the prices dropped dramatically. It went from $30,000 to like $4,000 to get an editing system that was just as good. So, yes, I went in, but the video was very different than what I didn't want to go back to that same kind of video. I wanted something that was more philosophically what I had developed in my landscape work.
And you call your new works videographs. Is that a term you coined?
It is, because I worked, I wanted to, when I broke with video initially, I started working with what I called 19th century photography with a large Deerdorf camera, and I'd put it on my back and carry it up into the mountains, Harriman State Park mostly, and set up this big 8x10 camera and take a lot of shots. And when I started doing landscape work with video, I was doing the same thing. I mean, it was taking a half hour to line up a shot, and so I decided this grew from that. And so I decided to call it a videograph.
Some of your new works are very realistic. Others are pixelated to the point where the video resembles a subtly shifting abstract painting. and you go back and forth between the two. Do the abstract works begin as realistic videos before you enlarge the images until they become pixelated?
Yeah, they're definitely derived from it.
And you're also adjusting the color, I imagine.
Yes, very much so. There's Michael Powell. I mean, Michael Powell is such a colorist. It's and such a designer of image. I mean, you can say the same thing, not about color, but about Eisenstein. But I think it was Powell for me. His sense of composition and his sense of movement through the frame and color. Oh, color.
And then there are seascapes. Do you see them as related to the seascape paintings of artists like Winslow Homer or J.M.W. Turner or Claude Monet?
Yes, yes, and yes, but also back to Dutch painting. Mm-hmm. I think it was Kuyp who did a lot of seascapes. Very different looking, but the light was similar. The light in Kuyp's paintings were just amazing, and the Frick had a few that I used to go and visit all the time.
I think sometimes your sense of space, too, your composition, you know, your sense of the landscape being there, but not being so full and so occupied. There's distance between the forms, and I think that's actually very, very much Kuyp reflected in your work.
There's a piece in the Bronx Show called A Wave from 2009, which looks like a very slowly shifting abstract painting up close, but when you move back, it's clearly a wave. Do you want viewers to see it as both abstract and a realistic image?
Yes, but isn't that what is the meaning of abstract? And when I was, you know, my degree is in science, so for us, abstract was a contraction of what the meaning of the larger written piece was going to be, and it's put in the beginning of a paper. It's called an abstract. So for me, that's what abstract meant. It's a kind of quick distillation of what is a larger issue.
Noam, as an art historian, this has become obviously something that you've been interested in over the years, the whole issue of what is abstract, what is realistic, what is relevant, what isn't relevant. Do you see that as having even more of an impact when we're talking about video art?
I think certainly questions of abstraction and representation aren't going to go away. Relevant and irrelevant, both. My sense today, if I'm being blunt, is abstract painting has probably largely run its course, but understanding the technologies that shape so much of our world and so much of ourselves still enables, perhaps even requires, a certain level of abstraction with those technologies, with those images, with those systems, partially as a classic estrangement effect, distanciation effect, getting us away from the technology to better understand it, but also just to explore possibilities that are not the ones rammed down our throats by corporate interests. So I see still a lot of opportunity around abstraction and video abstraction and other new media technologies that I think will remain challenging for us for years to come.
And a lot of artists have applied the things they learned from abstraction to realistic works, compositionally, for example.
I just want to interject something from psychology, that our brain, all it does, or a lot of what it does, is abstract, because we can't possibly understand all of the stimuli that's coming through our eyes and our ears and our senses. So everything we do is an abstraction, is a simplification. And so when I turned to abstraction, it was to simplify something that made to make it more visible, which is basically what our brain is doing anyway.
Kristen, when a collector purchases a digital video artwork, what do they get? Are there recommended players and monitors to use with them?
Of course. I mean, again, it depends on the artwork itself, the nature of the artwork. Currently at the gallery, we have two pieces by Peter that are playing in the space. One is hyper naturalistic, shot in 4K, shown in 4K. The other is an abstraction.
Shot 5 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
So
5 years apart
relevant?
In essentially the same location. I definitely think the distance of 5 years is meaningful, but also this, again, the installation asks you to think about the relationship and the nature of realism and abstraction, because you're seeing the same site in two incredibly different ways. Each one has interpretations, manipulations, directions provided to you, the viewer, from the artist. If you acquired one of those works, what you are essentially acquiring from us is that chip that I mentioned, a player. We usually supply a professional-grade media player, and currently BrightSign is Peter's preferred media player, an archive copy, so essentially a second chip, and a certificate of authenticity.
Because they can be copied.
Well, they're not actually quite as easily copied as everyone thinks they are, but the important aspect of that is that you have a certificate in your name and a sort of trail of documentation indicating that you, in fact, own that work.
So then we play it on our regular TV set?
It depends on you and your interests. Very often, when somebody acquires the work, we also help them acquire a new smart TV. And again, it varies according to the location, the space, their home, etc. Sometimes they might have the piece finished off with a frame, a certain kind of framing around it. Other clients have actually had the works set into the wall and, you know, a sort of wall built as a frame around the piece. It really, again, has to do with context and location.
Any last thoughts, Noam?
I think on this question, there's an interesting reversal that's taken place. In probably the most quoted essay on modern art, Walter Benjamin's Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, or more precisely, technological reproducibility, he talks about the aura value of, you know, the great Da Vinci painting, say, versus the mechanical reproduction, you know, the postcard of, you know, a Da Vinci that can circulate endlessly, and that one of them has this great aura that people make pilgrimages to experience, and the other is, you know, this cheap reproduction that just arrives ready-made at the masses. To a certain extent, video has reversed that. So today, it's extremely easy to get very, very good reproductions of most major artworks, most major paintings. But for video art, overwhelmingly, you have to go and experience it firsthand. You can't get a good copy of any of Peter's work on the internet. You certainly can't experience it. Any of the works that involve live feedback, you can't experience it over the internet. You have to actually get up and go to the Bronx Museum or go to wherever it may be installed, which tend to be rare sites, and in a sense make a pilgrimage to this video artwork that is inherently reproducible, but only can be experienced in a specific time and space. So from, you know, the 1930s, when Benjamin prophesizes the end of aura and the end of the auratic original artwork painting in favor of reproduction, we have a strange reversal where the paintings are infinitely reproduced and available, but video, which is a reproducible medium, is actually only available in its specific installation in a specific time and space.
Well, actually, I watched some videos on YouTube of Peter's work, and then went to the museum, the Bronx Museum, and to Kristen's gallery. The experiences are so totally different. It's just amazing.
Yes.
We pretty much run out of time, but I want to remind people that Peter Campus Video Ergo Sum is on view at the Bronx Museum of the Arts at 1040 Grand Concourse on 165th Street. It'll be there until July 22nd. His show at the Kristen Tierney Gallery, which is at 219 Bowery, the second floor, will be there until April 20th at its Peter Campus, Shinnecock Bay. And his video, Head of a Sad Young Woman, is being screened every night until March 31st from 11:57 p.m. to midnight in Times Square as part of the Times Square Arts Midnight Moment. And my great thanks to the three of you for being on our show today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Peter Campus, Kristen Tierney, and Noam Elcott, to Barbara Kahn, who produced today's segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopez at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopez at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.